From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our Project Milwaukee series on water flows on with two organizations at the confluence of water issues here.
We'll speak with the head of the Milwaukee Water Council about where they fit in the dynamic of solutions to water problems.
We're not out there actually going and cleaning up the rivers or the lakes, but hopefully our technologies can help the Milwaukee Water Commons or the River Keeper to be able to do a better job and to have a bigger impact.
Plus, we'll learn about the work of the Milwaukee Water Commons, which sees water as a gift for everyone.
As we introduce more and more people to the fact that this is their water as well as everyone else's, I think that that will in some way heal us around these issues of segregation.
We'll explore how we can all conserve water.
And a conversation with the legendary David Crosby ahead of his concert in Milwaukee Saturday night.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. All this week, WUWM News and Lake Effect have been examining the issue of access to clean water in the region in our Project Milwaukee series, Great Lakes, Troubled Waters.
Today, we're stepping back a little and examining the idea of the region as a water hub, a place where industry, research, and academia converge. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from Brenda Coley, the co-executive director of the Milwaukee Water Commons, which takes a community and environmental approach to water issues.
But first, Dean Amhaus joins us in the studio. He's the president and CEO of the Milwaukee Water Council, a nonprofit organization that brings together these disparate entities. Amhaus begins by explaining what he means by the concept of a water hub.
Well, I think it's important to understand when we talk about hub, that it's really a convergence or a confluence of lots of different things, which we're very fortunate to have here in Milwaukee. It's not just having a passion around water. There's a lot of places that have that. But we're fortunate enough is that we've got universities that are focused around water, and certainly UWM with the School of Freshwater Sciences. But oftentimes people don't think about the College of Engineering or Marquette University and their engineering, or UW Whitewater and business and water. So there's all these universities. But we also have a unique aspect of all of these businesses that have been here for many of them decades and decades, that have grown and matured, that has this concentration. Right now, within our region, are almost 240 water technology companies, and that is very unique. And the other thing I would say is that we have very strong utilities. These are utilities that are coming up with new innovations. They're very progressive in that way. In fact, you know, Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District is really looked upon as a world leader in terms of the practices that they do. So it's being able to have all of these in a very defined region. And we talk about our region. It's basically about an hour and a half drive. So we pick up Sheboygan and Kohler and Madison and even pull into northern Chicago as well.
So is that what makes others look to Milwaukee as a resource around innovation and technologies around water?
Well, it's not only the fact that we've got the companies and we've got the universities and utilities, but what's coming out of these entities are also what people are looking for. People from around the world, and literally we've got tens, dozens more than that coming every single year, that are looking for new solutions that our companies are coming up with, our universities are, you know, developing. But they're looking for business-to-business relationships, or they're looking to come here because we have this ecosystem that they can literally get plugged in. As an example, we talk about the fact that a company could come in on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock, and by 11 o'clock that morning, they could be plugged into an ecosystem that they couldn't get anywhere else. That's really one of the things that defines Milwaukee and separates us out across the entire world.
I'm thinking of places like Israel who have been leaders, world leaders in freshwater innovation because they live in a desert and they're surrounded by salt water. And so what are places like Israel learning from Milwaukee? And what is Milwaukee learning from Israel?
Well, and I think that's the thing, is each one is a little bit different and unique. And so as you talk about salt water desalination in Israel, that's something that's very, very important to them. It's not an issue that we have to deal with. What we end up having to deal with is too much water when we get these storms that come in. So they start to complement each other as well. There's a lot of innovations that are coming out of Israel, but Israel's a small country. And so for those entrepreneurs, they have to export if they are going to be able to grow as a business. For our businesses here in the Milwaukee region, it's a huge market just in the United States, but then they can also start working globally. But oftentimes, Milwaukee is compared with Israel or the Netherlands as well. And I think what's interesting is those other two places are countries. And so Milwaukee is really stacking up with that. And we actually had a presentation come to us from another entity out of Germany that was putting Milwaukee really at the top of the level with other countries in terms of innovations. It's not necessarily just because of water stress. You've got to have that concentration of innovation that we have.
We talk about innovation, but one of the things that's kind of fundamental here is that we have drinking water issues. We have a lot of people who have either lead contamination or other issues, whether it's well or runoff and that sort of thing. How is the Water Council working to mitigate those problems? Because everyone needs clean water.
Right, absolutely. And it's not only the individuals, but the businesses, and it's really important. So there are companies that are coming up with new innovations on the lead pipe issues. And I think the thing people often think is that you just have to rip the lead pipes out and then that's going to solve the problem. Well, I think as we're coming to learn, it's very expensive to be able to do that. It's very time intensive. And there are companies coming up with new solutions. It may be a liner that goes in the pipe and to be able to seal it off, or an entire house system that you can literally put into, off your main water line that can purify the water for the entire house or point of use. So there are many alternatives as well. And when you start looking at from a farming issues, there's a technology aspect of things, but there's also in terms of approaches on how we manage our water and the use on the agriculture and the farms. And I think it's got to be a combination of things. There is no one solution to any of this. It's got to be able to work collectively together. But that's one of the things that we're doing in terms of our companies are coming up with those innovations to be able to drive down the time, drive down the cost, and have a positive impact for people and businesses.
How often do you work with other nonprofits who are in some aspect of the water business? I'm thinking like the Water Commons, which comes at it from an environmental standpoint.
Right.
And I'm sure there are many others that are just not coming to mind right now. How closely do you work with them?
Not necessarily so closely because, one of the things that we talk about as an organization, we're an economic development organization. So I think back there was a commercial that used to talk, I think it was BSAF, where it said, we're not the ones making the planes, we're the ones that are helping to make it more energy efficient. Same type of thing for the Water Council. We're not out there actually going and cleaning up the rivers or the lakes, but hopefully our technologies can help the Milwaukee Water Commons or the Riverkeeper to be able to do a better job and to have a bigger impact. So, hopefully that innovation translates and comes back down to that NGO that can have a real direct impact, not only in Milwaukee, but across the entire world.
And I assume that there's also help in there somewhere in making it affordable to those NGOs
Absolutely.
And those nonprofits.
Absolutely. Affordable, but also easy to be able to do. Because, one of the things that we hear oftentimes is an NGO will go across the world into Africa or India and have a great solution. But the practical standpoint is it doesn't necessarily work under those conditions. And so it's got to be able to make it cost effective, but it's also going to be very user friendly as well.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you see sitting in your seat ahead for the water innovation business? I mean, what are some of the biggest things people are tackling?
Well, it's interesting is that, oftentimes we'll have people from the media who will say, why aren't these companies creating these innovations and getting it out into market in 18 months, or 9 months? Well, it's not like creating an app for your phone where if something's not quite right to you, just download a little bug fix. These are companies you have to think almost like a pharmaceutical company that are coming up with a new drug. They've got to test, because they have to make sure that once they're in operation that they're working 100% of the time, because we got to make sure that they're safe in terms of their usage as well. So it's a long period of time. That creates some other barriers because from an entrepreneur standpoint, they're always looking to be able to find venture capitalists that want to get into this. Well, those venture capitalists want a quick and early return. It doesn't set up a really good model. We're fortunate here in Milwaukee also that we have utilities that are willing to innovate and to be able to put dollars towards that. A lot of other places, that's not the case at all. So those are part of those slow things to the adoption of those new technologies. Is it's a long process for that innovation to be able to perfect it and to be able to get funded as well. That's some of the biggest barriers that are out there. Also, you know, the challenge is that we keep on coming up with new issues that we find in our water as well. And so, you know, as we said to the governor, you know, it's great to be able to have a year of water for the state of Wisconsin, but it's frankly it's going to be a decade of water or even longer than that as well, because it's going to take a long time for this.
How important is it to have governmental backing for what you're doing, even though you're an economic development nonprofit?
It's very important. We live in an environment and a society where you have to have the government relations and engagement as well. And that's whether it's from the governor's office to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which we're very close partners with as well. And so it is a partnership. I will say is that the Water Council has been really driven by the private sector, but a lot of the things that we are doing couldn't be done without, you know, all those other partners. To be able to get the regulations approved on a fast fashion with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, to be able to help those entrepreneurs to be able to perfect their innovations, to be able to get it out into the marketplace as well. So you can't separate them out at all. They've got to be a part of that whole solution.
So as you look into the future, the both the near and far future, what are some of the things you're most excited about, some of the projects that you can talk about that you think are going to make a huge difference to us?
Well, you spoke about earlier in terms of desalination. And when you start going around the United States and around the world, you hear people talk about, you know, that's sort of like the golden solution. If we can come up with the ability to take our salt water and to turn it into, you know, fresh, clean water, it can be done. Technology can make that work. The problem is it's very, very expensive, and it's a huge energy use to be able to do that. I believe that one of the innovations where we're going to start seeing and moving forward with is really getting into more water recycling. And we're, frankly, we've been doing it forever, for entire existence. What we as human beings have to get over what they call is that yuck factor. But frankly, when you start to get into heavy water stress areas, what we should be doing is, yes, desalinate the water, but then keep it in a closed loop and literally just start to recycle and reuse it continuously.
And you're talking gray water and black water,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. And it can be done. All of those things can be done. It's for us, our minds, to sort of get over what we're drinking. They've been doing it up in, you know, space for a long, long period of time.
They have.
So it's more of we human beings to be able to get over that. The other thing, which I think is going to be a way of the future, is really getting more into smaller, decentralized systems. It's very expensive to do these big drinking or wastewater utilities, and they take a huge footprint up. I think one of the things that we're looking at is, can you create not just two or three drinking water utilities, but what if you had 100 or 150 and really create sort of a microgrid of all these utilities and to start to back up each other as well. And you can be able to produce clean water and deal with the wastewater at the same time.
My only thought of that is that we as human beings tend to want to centralize and tend to want to, you know, create bigger companies out of smaller companies. And I wonder if we could resist doing that, if we created a microgrid or you know, of small companies that, the urge is going to be to kind of make it all one anyway.
But it doesn't mean that it has to be, you know, one company. And one company could still, or the utility could still manage that. But what you've got is not a big, huge physical plant. Okay. So it's not different utilities. For instance, the waterworks, instead of managing two facilities, maybe managing 200, but it literally is all connected as well. And especially when you start getting into disaster areas where you've got hurricanes come in, and if it knocks out one facility, then a city is really held hostage. If you could have this grid set up so it starts to support the entire system, that's going to be a big help for those communities.
What do you think is the most important thing Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin should be looking at first in terms of clean water?
You know, that's a really tough question, because anybody you can, would ask, it's whatever is the most direct an impact on them. Certainly the lead pipe is a big, issue as well. But I think one of the things that we also realize is, as an example, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District, the things that are impacting that utility may be happening outside of its district, north of its district, because of farm runoff. It ultimately comes down, and impacts here as well. So, it's hard to say here's one particular thing. And that presents the challenge, is you can't, put your finger on one thing. You've got to be able to address the whole problem as well.
Exactly. It's why we have the whole week dedicated to aspects of this.
Right. Because, you get into stormwater, you get into drinking water, and you get into wastewater. And oftentimes people ask us from around the world, well, what do you focus on, when you start looking at water? And we say everything. And that's the challenge, but that's the necessity too.
Dean Amhaus is president and CEO of the Milwaukee Water Council.
We'll take a short break now and then get a big picture view of water issues in the region with one of the leaders of the Milwaukee Water Commons. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we heard from Dean Amhaus, whose organization, the Milwaukee Water Council, works with entities from industry to academia to solve water issues and problems in the area. Brenda Coley's group, the Milwaukee Water Commons, does the same thing, but from a different perspective. They make water personal.
Coley joined us in the studio for our Project Milwaukee series, and she talked about the mission of the Milwaukee Water Commons, which was founded 5 years ago.
It was founded by these two women. They were environmentalists, and they were interested to know what did the community think of the way the city was positioning itself as a water-centric city. And so they wanted to know what would that mean and what would that look like for the community. So they did around 1,200 to 1,500 interviews with people and asked them about water. And about 5 years ago, this was not as common as it is today. So they went to community-based organizations. They had held public meetings around subjects and came up with a water city agenda. So if we're truly going to be a water city, this is what the community felt it should look like. So we have six initiatives as part of a water city agenda. We have green infrastructure, we have water quality, we have drinking water, we have arts and culture, education and recreation, and blue-green jobs. And these are the initiatives. They each have 10-year goals. It's about 3 years old now, and we are working towards really making the city look like the water-centric city it is.
And so how are you working with other organizations who are working on, say, the technology side, like the Water Council, which is more on the business and innovation side of things? Is there partnership happening there?
We work with everyone because we have a philosophy, a commons philosophy, that in order to deal with the issues surrounding water and the complications and our responsibility towards it, that we have to work with everyone. So we welcome working with the Global Water Center. We work with Riverkeeper. We work with really all the organizations inside the environmental field, inside the sector of water, and outside. Because one of the things that Milwaukee Water Commons wants to do is engage people back to the water. So we want to provide that pathway to the water. We believe that the water belongs to no one, belongs to everyone, but we should all share in its benefits.
What are some of the challenges that the organization has found getting people to care about the resource of water?
Well, you know, it's really not that hard to get people to understand water. And we don't look at water as a resource. You know, we really look at it as a friend and as a benefit, you know. And anytime you put someone in front of water, they get it. So the issue is getting them there. That's the challenge. And with a highly segregated city, there are issues and unwritten boundaries around these kinds of issues, around water. And so we work to really provide a pathway for people to get back to water. Because every culture, every community has a water story, has more than one water story. And we work with getting people to understand, to see, to uplift those stories, and to have people engage in the water. Because with the Commons philosophy, if water belongs to no one and belongs to everyone, we also have a responsibility regarding this water. And as we have learned from Native and Indigenous people, really the responsibility is 7 generations from now. We owe them clean water.
So what are some of the ways that the Water Commons is working to open those pathways to people who might not feel that they have any connection to water?
Well, we have several ways that we really engage the community with water. One is Water School, which is a 4-session day-long event on Saturdays in the summertime, once a month, where we work with people around water. We tell them about their water footprint. We talk about the health of the watershed, and we do some activities that really engage them to the water. So we try to meet in each of the 4 watersheds over the summer. We talk about the cultural aspects of that watershed. We talk about how our everyday behavior affects the watershed. And we attach them to a artist who does a rendering, an artistic rendering, standalone art project around water. And this is a way to engage artists who don't necessarily think about water, but to have water in their work. And then we have, they do a project based on our 6 initiative Water City Agenda, and we give them pass-through funds to do that. We also are organizing for our 2nd annual Cream City Classic, and that is the race that we have in the Milwaukee River at the point of the confluence, where we're bringing people, you know, to think about really what we're trying to do is highlight the work, the clean work that's been done around the river. We've made some tremendous progress in that area, and we want people to know and to encourage them or to think about that the rivers are there for us to swim in. They're there for our benefit. And so people don't think about the rivers in that way. So we have this race. We have this swim. We had 68 people come last year, and it was really a transformative kind of day. We also have a program called We Are Water. And this is one of our cultural programs that we have at the lakefront at dusk. For the past 4 years, it's been at Bradford Beach. And for the last year, we had it at South Shore Park. So we engage the community around the cultural aspects of water, and we talk about the water, the health of the water. So there are several things. That's just a sampling of some of the things that we do.
As you know, there are a lot of people in Milwaukee without access to clean drinking water, or at least water without too much lead in it. How do we square that, having access to clean drinking water, with this idea, the broader effort of making Milwaukee an international water hub? I mean, we're dealing with really wonderful ideas on one hand, and then mm-hmm. we're dealing with the harsh reality of people not having clean water to drink on mm-hmm. the other. Mm-hmm. How do mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. make that all work? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one thing I want to say, that this is a nationwide problem, and it's also a problem across the state of Wisconsin. So Milwaukee's not the only place that is at risk of drinking unclean water. You know, we have issues with agricultural runoff. We have issues with bacteria in water and wells and things like that. So this is a statewide problem. And that's why it was fantastic when the governor declared 2019 as the year of clean drinking water. You know, this is a big, hairy problem that I think will take really all stakeholders, all of our efforts to get this resolved. Milwaukee Water Commons, you know, believes that it's possible to have the lead laterals change within a generation, and that they should be changed within a generation. It is a risk. It's a public health risk and something we don't think our community should be subjected to. But until we change those lead laterals out, we also believe that, you know, for the health of our community, that we should have full-fledged filter distribution. So we believe that 70,000 filters should be on the homes of the folks, of 70,000 people who have lead laterals. And, you know, you could have a very robust public health campaign, and we could do it much like the way that we did in the 70s and 80s around smoke detectors, where we had the fire department come in and install those smoke detectors and show people how to put the batteries in. And at the time, the communications around that is that people wouldn't change the batteries, but we engaged the public. We taught them what to do. You have a day in November where it's a national change your battery day. So the same thing needs to be done around filters, because you really don't want a situation where you give folks filters and they don't know how to put them on their sink. So we really need a full-fledged, robust program to get that done.
Is that something that the Water Commons is working toward?
It's something that we're working towards, and many organizations in the city are working towards it. But the reality and the issue is that this is to bring this up to scale and to do it in a timely manner. It really means a bigger effort from our city.
Too much for one organization to do on your own.
There's no organization, no community-based organization in the city of Milwaukee that I know of that can put 70,000 filters on 70,000 homes. But our city government could.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation one of the core beliefs of the Water Commons is that water belongs to no one and it can't be owned. And that got me thinking about, that's true. It is something that is all of ours and none of ours. But access to it can be owned and regulated and often is. And so how do you work to ensure equal access?
So we're talking about a broader sense of access, all around access. And I think that that is an issue that we delve into at Milwaukee Water Commons delves into. And other places do so too. Harbor District is one of the organizations that really is trying to bring the neighborhood to the water. So we're all working on that to really make these spaces more inclusive and to make everyone feel that they belong there. And some of it is just, you know, providing the access. For example, for Water School, we take people to Mothy Lake. And we're really talking to folks about how these headways, you know, this is the headway of the Milwaukee River. What happens there affects us as well. But we had stations where people could fish. We have places where people could kayak, and we have places where people could swim. And this is so people have an engagement with the water, you know, and this is literally traditionally a very white space. We're bringing all kinds of folks to that space. Everyone felt good. It was a transformative day situation. Everyone likes that. And then without us, it's only an hour away, people can drive there and recreate there. So those are the kinds of things that we're opening up for folks, that this water is for us all, and it's a gift.
What do you think are the biggest challenges going forward to making sure that people can do everything? It's not just the water coming out of the tap that's safe, but mm-hmm. that you can go swim in it, that you can go fish, and that everyone is mm-hmm. welcome mm-hmm. to do that.
I mean, to be honest, the interesting thing in water, we believe that if you heal the water will heal us, right? And so one of the issues that we have in Milwaukee is we have some rigid segregation going on, and you can see it around the water. So as we introduce more and more people to the gift of water, to the fact that this is their water as well as everyone else's, and I think that that will in some way heal us around these issues of segregation. So that's one of the challenges of that. It's, you know, you go to the lakefront in the summer and it can be a highly policed area. That's an issue that makes people feel that they are not welcome there. And this is, you know, this is the lake that belongs to everyone. So the many times that we can bring families, that we can bring young people to feel that this water also belongs to them, you know, I think that that will help relations in our city.
And make all of us want to take care of it.
Exactly. If you're just looking at it as a commodity, if you're only looking at it as a resource and you haven't understood or be engaged with it, the many wonders of water, you know, you don't think about taking care of it. But like I said, the minute that you put people in front of it, they get it. And as I said, we all have a water story. We know the Milwaukee River for African Americans has been a pathway to freedom. There's also been some trauma around water, too, for us. But those things, both of those things exist. And I think that we can get to the other side and appreciate water. So that's one of the things, you know, we do things around water and people going, wow, you know, I've never gone to the river. I've never gone to the Kinnickinnick. I've never gone to the Menominee. This is here. This is a resource for us, you know, and we're grateful for it now.
Well, I am grateful that you were able to come in today, Brenda Coley. It is such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you,
Bun.
Brenda Coley is the co-executive director of the Milwaukee Water Commons. We spoke with her for our Project Milwaukee series, Great Lakes, Troubled Waters, and you can find other segments from the series at WUWM.com.
Coming up, a look at what you can do to conserve water in your home. That's when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Quality is perhaps the most important part of any water distribution system. Water utilities process every drop that makes it into our plumbing, which takes a lot of time and energy. One way to keep from overburdening the system is by reducing our consumption, what we know as water conservation.
Bill Graffin works for the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, which works in wastewater treatment and conservation efforts in the Milwaukee area. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers on the shore of Lake Michigan and starts by explaining what water conservation looks like at home.
At our homes, we use about 55 gallons of water a day. A lot of different ways you can cut down on that. Shorter showers. It's amazing people don't think about when you have a leaky faucet or toilet. That can be a lot of water, especially if you let it go for a month or a year. A leaky toilet alone can waste up to 200 gallons of water a day. That's a big volume when you're looking at not fixing it for maybe a month or two or three. So those are the things we want to get fixed. And it's to help you, the homeowner, save money, water, and energy as well. Because you're, in some cases, when you have, if people don't think about this very often, but if you have a leaky, hot water spigot on your faucet, you're not only wasting water down the drain, but that water is being heated. And you're paying for that.
So now not only are you paying for the water that's coming up, but you're paying for the gas or oil, whatever you use to heat your water.
Electricity, yeah.
So, you know, leaky faucets, leaky toilets, things that we might not notice in our daily lives are dripping. What are some of the other culprits in our home that tend to use a lot of water?
Well, it goes right back to the things we were just talking about. And that is older appliances, older toilets, older faucets. Really old toilets can be 3 to 5 gallons of water per flush, sometimes higher. But now the new ones are all around 1.28 gallons per flush, and you can get them with a lower amount than that. There was a little bit of ridicule for these low flush, low flow toilets when they first came out. The technology just wasn't there, but it's really come around, and they're great. You can get a lot of things down one of those. Towels, you name it.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
You don't want to do that, though.
Probably not. So, you know, older appliances are certainly going to take up a lot of water. Are there things that in our daily lives that we might be doing that use more water than we may think?
Well, on a cold winter day, if you get up and get motivated by standing in a hot shower for an hour, that uses a lot of water.
Yeah.
Just leaving the water on when you're doing things instead of turning it off in between, you know, picking up dishes and things like that. It's You know, it's always a good idea to run a full load of dishes in the dishwasher instead of just leaving the faucets on while you do, you know, the same amount of dishes. You can run through a lot of water that way.
Okay, so if you're somebody who kind of alternates between hand washing and doing a load in the dishwasher, maybe think about the load.
Absolutely, yeah. Makes a big difference.
What about things like washing machines? I've always wondered, like, are there certain settings that are really taking up a lot more water than I would imagine? Are there certain kinds of machines that use a lot of water?
The newer machines are more environmentally friendly in the amount of water that they use. And also with energy, just general consumption, the newer equipment's always going to be better, whether it's Energy Star or water drop rated. You want to look for those things and read up on it before you purchase. It's hard because you get some stains that won't come out without hot water, and some people just like to use cold water when they do it. And then if you wash it three times to get the same stain out, what makes more sense?
Yeah. So dishwashers, laundry machines, I'm trying to think of all of the various ways that we use water in our homes, but one that obviously comes to mind is gardening. You know, people water their lawns, whether they be, you know, grass lawns or native grass lawns. How do our gardens impact our water quality here?
Well, they can really impact local water quality if you're using chemicals and that washes off into the creek, stream, or river nearby. Same thing with fertilizer for your lawn. You want to use an environmentally friendly fertilizer if you're going to use one. And don't overapply, because anything that doesn't get absorbed by the soil or the grass or vegetables or whatever is potentially going to run off and get into our drinking water.
One of the things that came up with another conservation group was something like rainwater buckets. How are those helpful in conserving water?
Well, you're capturing as much water as you want and storing it until, you know, maybe it's dry out, and then you don't have to use city water to give your thirsty plants, bushes, trees a drink. The rain barrels, for example, are around 50, 55 gallons of water, but they'll also fill up in 4 minutes. During a really heavy rain, each downspout on your house can kick out about 12 gallons a minute. So think of that as free water by the barrel. And plants and garden plants, grass, they love that natural rainwater, more so than water from the tap. So the rain barrels are a great idea. You can also do cisterns, which are just bigger rain barrels. They're rain barrels on steroids. You can get them 1,000 gallons or bigger. Some of those, because of state plumbing code, you got to be careful. They may require you to put a cleaning type device on it, especially if it's underground. But yeah, there are a lot of ways to capture water and harvest that water for reuse, especially at times where it's real dry.
Yeah, when you capture water in this way, how can you use it?
You can use it for your gardens. You can use it for watering plants, even inside your house or outside the house. Trees, if you're establishing a new tree, they need a lot of water, especially that first year. And you know, that's a great way to get free water and water with some nutrients in it, and no chlorine, hopefully.
But not something you should be drinking.
No, you don't. You don't want to do that, just like you don't want to drink from what you walk up to and consider the clearest mountain stream, because you'd never know what's in that water without putting it under a magnifying glass. You know, conservation also plays into cleaner water, because when you're managing water where it falls, if you're capturing it with a rain barrel or a cistern, or you're using a rain garden to help manage water that's coming off your roof down a downspout, put it into a rain garden, that's water that isn't going to flow downhill and become somebody else's headache. And it's water that's not going to flow downhill and pick up pollution along the way and get into the nearest creek, stream, or river as polluted water. So every time we do that, every little drop counts. You can help keep our rivers and Lake Michigan cleaner, ultimately.
What is a rain garden?
Rain garden is a garden that's a shallow depression in the ground. You don't have to dig down very deep. But then you plant it with native plants or plants that have deep growing roots. They help break up that soil and help drain more water into the ground. And then you run your downspout into that rain garden, and then you're getting the water that way into there, or you can also use your sump pump hose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we know how much water they save?
They can store quite a bit of water. It just depends how big you make it and what you plant it with. If you use soil amendments to plant the plants in, number of variables and factors there.
Bill Graffin works for the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers as part of our Project Milwaukee series. You can find more interviews from the series at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then a conversation with a music legend. We'll hear from David Crosby ahead of his concert Saturday night at the Pabst Theater. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
This is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tite.
Let us be talking about very free and easy.
For those of us of a certain age, the voice we're hearing now is instantly recognizable. From the Byrds to Crosby, Stills, and Nash to his own solo career, David Crosby has sailed his own ship. In more than a half century, the California native has penned scores of classic songs, and at 77, after diabetes, a liver transplant, and two heart attacks, he is still going strong.
In fact, the last few years have marked a burst of creativity that leads Crosby and his Lighthouse Band to the Pabst Theater on Saturday night in support of their newest album, Here If You Listen. David Crosby joins us from his home in California. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
It's a pleasure.
And we are so looking forward to having you play here in Milwaukee as well. And I have to say, listening to the newest album, God, that band is fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
The four of you just make such gorgeous sounds.
Yeah, we do. That's the Lighthouse Band, and it's the more acoustic one of the two bands. That's the one that Michael League is the producer for. And he did a fantastic job. And those two girls, Becca Stevens and Michelle Willis, are just two of the most talented people I've ever run across, ever, anywhere.
When you were writing the tunes for this, was this band in mind already, or did that come together afterwards?
I don't really write for a band. The bands, you know, there's the Sky Trails Electric and the Lighthouse Acoustic, right? And I don't write specifically for one. I just write. And then when the song gets developed, you know, I start, you know, singing the song. Then I kind of think about which set of tools will probably deliver the best record. But I don't really think about it initially. I just kind of tease the song out of the unknown and into the known.
Well, and the way it all came together on this, it's both each song individually, but the entire album, I felt like I was listening to an album. And I'm old enough to remember albums, not just bits and pieces that you pull off the internet, but where mm-hmm. you sat down and you dropped the needle and you played the whole album. And this feels like that.
It does, and I'll tell you why. What happened is, when I made the Lighthouse record with Michael, he brought Becca and Michelle into it, and he's the one who introduced me to both of them. You know, at that point, it was still a David Crosby record. They sang a couple of harmonies. But what happened in the room when the four of us started vocaling something was spectacular. So I went to them the next time and I said, listen, I want to do another record, but I don't want to do a solo record. I want to do a record of the four of us writing it and the four of us singing it. And they said, are you sure? And I said, I'm very sure. I'm not very good at a whole lot of things, but I'm very good at spotting musical chemistry. Proof's in the pudding. And I said, I'm absolutely sure that if we do that, we will make a great record. And that's Here If You Listen. We wrote it together, and we sang it.
Vain.
endless fishing, endless, aimless in the flooded palace where the king of Venice used to lie.
Lonely woman, plants a rooftop garden.
Were they surprised that you wanted to do this with them, that you felt that they deserved equal billing?
Normally, you know, people who've got 50 years in don't do that. They are very, very protective of their status. And I think that most writers, you know, feel that way. But how I feel, man, is that the other person always thinks of something you didn't. I think it always, always increases the possibilities. You have to be very picky about who you do it with. Now, I write mostly with my son, James Raymond. He's a really brilliant musician, better than me, and a brilliant songwriter. And I write with Michael Leake, brilliant composer, brilliant songwriter, brilliant musician. And I write with Becca Stevens and Michelle Willis, both of whom are stunner writers. I wrote recently with Michael McDonald. That was a very good song. I've written with Phil Collins. I've written with a lot of people over the years. I wrote one song with Joni, which is probably, you know, my best honor of writing with anybody else. But what I found is that if you're not trying to protect your reputation and get all the publishing money, which a lot of people are, if you're open, you can make some wonderful music by being open to other people and listening to all kinds of music and working cooperatively.
To me, that's been a hallmark of your musical career. Starting in the 60s and going forward, it seemed like there was always that eagerness, not just willingness on your part, but eagerness to try new things, to work collaboratively, to, you know, to explore the edges of things as opposed to sticking to something that was tried and true.
That's exactly right. You see me very clearly. That is who I am.
Well, and I appreciate it. As a listener and as a longtime fan, you know, it's like I love not knowing exactly where you're going to go next.
Yep. Well, that's you have perceived me correctly.
And so as you're taking this on tour, how has it evolved in the live setting? Have the tunes taken on a different shape at all?
They always do, yeah. It's really, when you get a band as good as my band Star, one thing, first of all, you never play anything the same twice, right? Everything, you're always winging it a little bit. I'm always winging it pretty much a lot. I never sing it the same twice. And so it's kind of like having your own rocket ship. You don't know where you're going to go, but you can go anywhere. The level of sophistication as players is pretty astounding. And the flexibility it gives me, I can go anywhere. We can play anything we can think.
You know, I have to think you've been doing this 50-plus years. Do you ever worry you're going to run out of things to sing about?
No. No, absolutely not. No, there's tons.
It seems like we never run out of stuff to comment on and think about and
well, come
and
on, you can
feel.
Only think about love.
Yeah.
In the first place, love is, that's endless. You can write about that your whole life, not write about anything else. You can write about that your whole life and never run out. But I'm fascinated by people, honey. They're just really sometimes totally strange, sometimes completely inspiring, but they're fascinating. So I'm always going to be writing about people. And then there's, you know, our job, part of our job is to be the town crier. You know, say, hey, it's 12 o'clock and you elect an idiot to run the country and things are not going so well.
Yeah, I mean, that's another part of you've never been shy about the politics. You've never shied away from it, and you've never been embarrassed to be that and have that in your music. And I think that is also something that people appreciate.
Yeah, I hope so. I can't change it. I'm definitely me.
It's a bubble. Balanced on a pin, this place I'm in.
So are there other albums in the works, or are you just busy with this one right now?
Yep. No. Okay, so there's four in a row, right? There's Cross, and then Lighthouse, and then SkyTrail, and then Here If You Listen. And we are, James and I, are halfway through on another one right now.
Oh, that's good news. That's good news, because I've loved all of those. And, you know, reading a lot of the, you know, the reviews and things, people love this new one in particular. But everyone's commenting on this sort of burst of creativity that you seem to be in. And, you know, it's, again, it's just so nice to see that you haven't run out of things to say and talk about.
Yeah, obviously I'm happy about it. That other people are happy about it is a joy. But I'm totally happy about it. And I think it comes down to this. Okay, I'm 77 years old. I got a certain amount of time, right? We don't know how much. 2 weeks, 10 years, some amount of time. The real strong part of this thing, the significant part, is not how much you have, but what you do with it. What do you do with that time? It's your last batch of time. What are you going to do with it? It should be really important to you. Well, it is really important to me. And the only thing that I can do that makes any difference, that helps anybody, that makes anything better at all, is make music. It's my gift. It's the thing that I can do that will make people happy and that makes things better. And it's the only thing I can do, really. So I'm trying to make music the best I can. You know, you got to absolutely try to do it at the highest level you possibly can. But I'm also trying to do it as fast as I can, because I don't know how much time I got. And I've got a lot of stuff I still want to get said.
Cause I've been thinking about dying and how to do it well. How to stand up and face it, or just lie where I fell. It's a matter of honor, having stood up somewhere, to spend my last hours clearing a path for your own right.
Well, and I hope there's plenty. I hope there's so much more time, because it's terrific to hear it and to hear you thinking about those things. And
I like it, but I don't think there is so much more time. You know, it could happen. I could live to be 100, but it's not likely. You got to remember, I'm a transplant, right? And yep. I've got diabetes, and I've had two heart attacks. So I don't think that's in the cards. I don't think I'm going to be around too much longer. But I do think that people are going to look at what I did during the last part of my life and say he used that time well.
David Crosby, it is such an honor to talk with you. I have been a fan since the 1960s, and I cannot wait to hear you and the Lighthouse Band here in Milwaukee.
Thank you, John. Appreciate your help.
He was walking along the road. I asked him, where are you going?
David Crosby and his Lighthouse Band play the Pabst Theater Saturday night. His new album is called Here If You Listen. We're listening to some of it now, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden.